Thank you for attending our talk today with Ross Rosen on C19, Heart, Shock, and POTS. My name is Kristen Tenbrock. I'm a licensed acupuncturist and classical Chinese herbalist, currently located in North Carolina. This talk is being recorded and hosted by the Facebook group Shanghan Wenbing and Wenyi. Our group started January 30th, 2020 in response to the current pestilential qi. Currently, we are the largest English-speaking Chinese medicine-specific practitioner group focusing on infectious and post-infectious disease. We provide a space for information sharing as it relates to infectious disease and East Asian medicine, and in particular, welcome your infectious and post-infectious disease case workups and discussions. Please join Shanghan, Wenbing, and Wenyi on Facebook if you haven't already. We have a wealth of information to share, which is growing every day. We will start this room off as a conversation, and later we'll open up the stage for questions and discussion from licensed acupuncturists. Please refrain from using the C word. Please know that we are not talking about the diagnosis or treatment of disease here, but rather we are offering information for educational purposes only. Our co-moderators today are Jesse Gottlieb Jacob and Christy Mendoza. Please introduce yourselves, and then I'll introduce Ross so we can begin our talk.
Thank you so much, Kristen. My name is Jesse Gottlieb Jacob. I'm a licensed acupuncturist and registered traditional Chinese medicine practitioner in Ontario, just east of Toronto. And I've made lots of great friends here on Clubhouse, and I've been running a daily Dao club room where we meet 9:30 Eastern Standard Time every weekday and chat about Taoism. We've been working our way through the Tao Te Ching. We talk about the trigrams, we do I Ching divinations, just have fun and sort of put our nose in the books a little bit in terms of interacting with the text and interacting with people's experience of Tao and how they're living it. And I'm really excited for this talk, and thank you very much for having me up.
Thank you. And Christy, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Christy Mendoza. I'm a licensed acupuncturist in Los Angeles, California. I have specialized since day one. I took over my mentor's clinic fresh out of school, who was a top naturopathic doctor. So I was kitchen table trained from him. So I've been integrated this my whole career, and I've continued to just add various forms of natural medicine from indigenous, Latin, I'm a voracious student. My patient load is extremely difficult, which really drives my quest for knowledge. And I also integrate not only functional medicine labs, but have been getting deeper and deeper into spiritual healing recently in the past 5 years. And I find that that approach is a really winning combination, going from the structural to the soul level, especially when with very difficult patients who there is no real diagnosis, or they can't figure out what's going on with them. So that's my approach. I've recently become very involved with the activist efforts with the long blank community. And I've been working with some amazing people over on that end. And I've been trying to see how we can get our foot in the door in the bigger conversation on a national level, integrating our medicine into that realm. And POTS and dysautonomia is a hot, hot topic right now in that scene. So I took Ross's class yesterday. I thought it was fantastic. It gave a lot of hope that it's not this very mysterious, far out thing that nobody can figure out. He presented it in a very simple way. I actually have been seeing them. I just didn't recognize that it was that constellation of diagnosis. So I'm very excited to be here, and thank you for welcoming me as a moderator.
Thank you. And thank you for mentioning that, because that you took Ross's class. I reached out to Lauren Brown to see if he would give our group members a discount to Ross's talk, and he actually agreed to 20% off that talk and Ross's other seminar that's on healthy seminars. So if you're interested in taking Ross's healthy seminars class, if you need some CEUs or you just want to learn more about this topic, especially now, it's very timely. The coupon is Clubhouse20, capital C. And I think it expires on the 20th of this month. And it's not at, like, if you already took the class, you won't be able to get the discount. But going forward, if you do, Lauren graciously offered 20% off of that. So that's a wonderful day. Okay. So thank you. And thank you both for being here. I appreciate your time and your expertise. And I'm going to introduce Ross now. So some information about Ross. Ross is a licensed practitioner of acupuncture and Chinese medicine. He's a direct lineage holder and senior certified instructor of Shanhammer Pulse Diagnosis. He's a board member of Dragon Rises Incorporated and a long-term student of Dr. Leon Hammer and Jeffrey Yuen. He's the founder of the Center for Acupuncture and Herbal Medicine in Westfield, New Jersey. Ross is an ordained 23rd generation Taoist priest in the Chuanzhen Longmen tradition at the Jian Fugong on Qingcheng Mountain, and a 25th generation Taoist priest in the Chuanzhen Longmen tradition at the Qianyuan Daoguan. And please forgive me if I've mispronounced any of that. He's one of the teachers at Parting Clouds Taoist Education. So thank you, Ross Rosen, for being with us today. Thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, you know, our talk is just kind of broadly, you know, your experience with C19, post-C19, heart shock and POTS. And if you can just give a general overview of what, for some people don't really know what POTS is. So it's postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And some people who might not be familiar with the Shanhammer lineage or heart shock or, you know, do you want to give us like a brief intro about your knowledge in these areas?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, when I was in Chinese medicine school back in the late 90s, you know, I had this kind of feeling that we were missing something in our education. You know, there's all this talk about being able to diagnose things from the pulse without having to rely on patient testimony or anything else. And not because patients don't try to do their best to tell us what's going on, but they're not always able to verbalize things. And there's also plenty of things that they're not aware of in terms of what's going on in terms of their own physiology and pathology. And so I had come across writings and teachings from Dr. Leon Hammer. And, you know, it was one of those epiphanies and light bulbs and just recognition that this person needed to be my teacher. I needed to go study with them. And as soon as I graduated, that's exactly what I did. I went and well, the first thing was I tried to study with one of Dr. Hammer's certified teachers at the time, is Dr. Bob Heffron. And I called him up, I signed up for one of his courses at the New England School of Acupuncture. This was like 2000, I think, or beginning of 2001. And I signed up, I took off for the weekend, I drove up to Massachusetts and showed up to NISA on that morning of the class to find, like, you know, locked doors and dark classrooms, and, you know, finally tracked someone down. And they told me that the class had been canceled because only two people had signed up for it. Cool. And so I was never notified. And so, of course, they had given me his phone number. I contacted him and he felt so terrible. And he invited me down to his house in Maryland, and I spent the weekend down there studying in my first training with him, and then from there kind of progressed on to lots of weekends with him, with Phyllis Bloom, who was one of the other certified teachers. And then I think in 2002, I went down, because you had to be invited to come down to study with Dr. Hammer at that time. You had to have a certain number of coursework under your belt and a certain level of mastery of the material before you would go down for these sort of 4-day intensives. And Phyllis had invited me down under her recommendation, and from there, meeting Dr. Hammer and studying it, you know, I just threw myself completely into the work. And it took, and still is, an evolving, ongoing process, studying the pulse and kind of trying to master what we feel on the radial artery, especially with such a sophisticated methodology where there's, you know, there's 28 different pulse positions, and there are over 90 discrete sensations that we feel on the fingertip with 9 different depths of pressure. And so, you know, it gets significantly complicated. But from there, one is able to understand so much of what is going on energetically in all the varied anatomical regions of the body and the organ systems and the nervous system and so forth. And that's where I had put my main focus of study. And over the years, I think it was back in 2005, 2006, started studying very heavily with Jeffrey Yuen and began to take classes, really everything he was offering in New York City and through the American University of Complementary Medicine PhD program, which I became a part of. And what I started to see was this incredible synergy between these two discrete lineages. And there were certain aspects to them that each kind of revealed further depth of the other. And one of these areas was in the area of trauma and heart shock. So heart shock is this sort of umbrella term that was coined by Dr. John Shen, who was the teacher of Dr. Hammer. So Dr. Hammer studied with him for a period of roughly 28 years in mentorship, and 8 of them were in direct you know, in the clinic, feeling pulses together and writing formulas and so forth. And from here, you know, this idea of heart shock is really, like I said, it's an umbrella term, and it refers basically to the impact of trauma, but not just any trauma. So, you know, we can talk about traumas in lots of different ways. When we start to use the word heart shock, what we're talking about are trauma that rises to a particular level where it becomes a systemic insult. And by that, it also becomes a block to further treatments. So if a patient has heart shock as this umbrella term, and we can break down what all the other discrete diagnoses that are contained within that, which I do in my textbook. But once they have that, unless someone is trying to address the trauma impact specifically, what you start to find is that the patient doesn't really heal fully, or you may get transient results, symptomatic results that don't really last. And so for me, the mixture of the treatments that were offered in the Shen-Hammer approach alongside the classical Chinese medical approach and the channel systems and all of what that offered became this kind of really complete model to unlock all the different mysteries and the sequela of impact from that particular diagnosis. And through that, through the pulse in particular, was, and also because I should step back, because so the Shen-Hammer system founded upon this system of diagnostics, the Shen-Hammer pulse, is very heavily reliant on the energetics of the heart itself. So it's able to diagnose things within the heart organ and within the cardiovascular system with incredible subtlety. And through that lens, being able to spot and diagnose a lot of the aspects of what POTS presents with, it just kind of was like a very specific key that opened up the lock to that diagnosis and patient population for me. So, you know, I started seeing POTS patients probably 15 or more years ago. And I don't even know that when I first started seeing it, I recognized it with any particular name, because really it was until recently, a fairly rare and unheard of medical disorder. I mean, the term itself was coined in 1993, but it was a very rare diagnosis. And it came with other names. You know, it was known as like mitral valve disorder at one point. It was known as like soldier shock syndrome at one point. And so there's so many different aspects. You can see even just by those names, the tie-in to heart shock as a diagnosis and how understanding all the varied components of what heart shock offers us, how that would show and shed light on what POTS diagnosis is and how people experience that in and of itself. So
thank you. And right now, as we see things popping up with, you know, C19, why is it, I guess, more important for people to become aware of this issue?
Yeah, well, so I think it's a few reasons. And when we're looking at the impact of C19, it's very important, I think, to understand the impact specifically to the liver and the gallbladder, right? And so this is where I kind of started my focus and where I started to see these very sort of signature pulse presentations and almost really pathognomonic findings of POTS. And what I wanted to take maybe a step back and just explain something about the liver, because I think it's within Chinese medicine, we very often see in TCM especially this diagnosis of liver qi stagnation, right? And people talk about liver qi stagnation as, well, they almost like throw that in as a diagnosis for no matter what someone comes in for. And Dr. Hammer has been really adamant about this, both, you know, in his lectures as well as his writings, that this is such a misunderstood diagnosis and concept, because the ability of the liver to create stagnation is really to be seen as an ecological adaptive response rather than a pathology. And the reason for that is because in order to create stagnation or in order to suppress some type of energetic dynamic, it requires a particular strength and integrity of that organ system. So while we may see a whole host of signs and symptoms and sequela that develop from liver qi stagnation, if it is not remedied, right, or if it lasts too long without treatment, the real problem and the more serious occurrence is the inability of the liver and gallbladder to contain pathology. And this is really where we start to see some of the most devastating consequences, one of which can be POTS. Some of other ones can be things that move into the range of autoimmune disease, lymphomas, breast cancers, because these are some of the things that I see along the liver when it's not containing pathology. And there's particular pulse qualities that demonstrate what this is. And, you know, it's a little harder to describe some of these pulse qualities. We don't have a visual format like Zoom with a PowerPoint presentation. But basically, if you think of the normal pulse and you break the anatomy of the artery into three depths, even though, you know, there's really nine from the skin all the way down to the bone in the Schenhammer system. But simplistically, if you break the radial artery into three depths, what you find is that the normal pulse should emerge from the bottom portion of that, what we label the organ depth. And it should rise up through the middle depth, which is called the blood depth, up to the top, which is the qi depth, and then gradually recede. And so it has the shape of sort of like a normal bell curve, right, or a sine curve. And what we can see clearly from this normal pulse is that at the surface of the pulse, when we first press in to engage the radial artery, the pulse is not as substantial as it is as we start to press down deeper through the pulse, where it should reach its fullness, its most substance, and most of its strength at the organ depth itself. What we find with the inability of the liver to contain pathology is sort of the opposite of that. We start to see floating pulses up in the qi area, sometimes even beyond, and up to where the skin depth is, And as we press down towards the organ depth, the pulse disappears completely. It spreads away from the finger, the vessel occludes, and there's no sensation hitting the finger in the left middle position. Now, this is what we call an empty pulse, and there's many different gradations of the empty pulse from early, middle, and late stage. But essentially, if you are encountering an empty pulse in the left middle position, what you have here is what we would call a separation of yin and yang in the liver, or some type of a state of chaos where the liver is no longer able to perform and engage in all the functions that you'd like to see it performing in. And so this is the weakness and the inability of the liver to contain pathology. And so why is that a problem? The problem is that if the liver can't suppress and contain pathology, what starts to happen now is you allow pathology to circulate through the rest of the system. And if that is something where we have a pathogen, a latent pathogen that's now being released, what we start to see is that moving out into the rest of the body, and it creates systemic impact, right? So that may be something like breast cancer now that was once contained into a tumor that now becomes metastatic, or a condition that one was kind of harboring internally that now becomes a full-blown autoimmune disease with particular flare-ups. And so this is such an important part. And when we understand the empty pulse as a lack of foundation and chaos, it also is, if you think about the functions of the liver, so that means we're not able to properly detoxify, right? We're not able to allow for the capillaries because, you know, liver is Jue Yin, right? So it deals with blood circulation as well. So then now we don't have the full exchange of gases and waste returning back to the heart and lungs for expulsion. It all builds up internally, right? And so this empty pulse in the left middle position is one of the pathognomonic findings that we will find in POTS patients. Whether it be related to C19 or as its sequela, it doesn't really matter. This is just one of those things that we need to be aware of. This is probably the most important aspect. And how this ties in to C19 is, and this whole idea of the liver and the gallbladder is really interesting because, you know, we know that C19 is sort of like this Xiaoyang presentation, right? It's very malarial in a way, right? And you had Heiner come on a number of weeks ago, and he talked a little bit about this, so I don't want to rehash what he said, but just for those who maybe weren't there, this is a really important thing to understand because this pathogen is sort of a goo pathogen. It's malarial, it's parasitic. It's why we see some of these particular treatments being very effective. Like from the Western perspective, we may look at things like ivermectin. From the Chinese medical perspective, we may look at things like the bases of, you know, Shao Chai Hutong and so forth, and some of like release pearls from what Heiner prescribes. And he talked about the idea of the gallbladder and the year of the rat, right? And the idea of pestilence and epidemics. And, you know, it's an interesting dynamic. And so the other portion of that is when we look at some of the main impacts that C19 has, it tends to be on the blood vessels, right? It's on the endothelial tissues. And that is regulated by Xiaoyang and Jue Yin, right? And so it's interesting also when we tie this into this understanding of the blood vessels as a curious organ. Because the gallbladder is a curious organ. And not only is the gallbladder a curious organ, but the gallbladder is really kind of the intermediary between the Zongfu and the curious organs, right? And on top of that, we can look at the relationship of the gallbladder and the heart as sort of these opposites on the clock, right? And so these are kind of there's a polarity here that takes place between the gallbladder and the heart and its regulation of the Xiaoyang. And so, you know, Dr. Shen looked at the Xiaoyang as regulating the circulatory system specifically, and he created herbal formulas specifically for that, which, you know, I have those detailed in my textbook. But what's interesting is that when the gallbladder gets overwhelmed, right, that means that also impacts the gateway to the curious organs, one of which is the vessels. And so we start to see impact very directly on this. And we know, and so why is this such a problem in the US is because the gallbladder, as in the general population, is incredibly overwhelmed, right? You know, we see almost everybody, if you palpate the gallbladder pulse, you see pulses that are tense and slippery and choppy, right? These are damp heat, inflammatory pulses, and blood stasis. We see this time in and time again, right? And we know also we have relationships of the gallbladder to the bones, right? We have, again, a curious organ. So we see all these different tie-ins that are really significant, because when we see stagnation in the liver and the gallbladder, what the impact of that is heat, right? Because heat is always generated when a metabolic activity is trying to overcome some type of stagnation. And so when it can't overcome it, the heat builds up. That creates fire and inflammatory processes, right? That inflammatory process also creates two different discrete phenomena. One is it creates dampness as a response, right, to that heat. And secondly, the heat also creates deficiency of fluids because it burns off the fluids. And as it does this, that burning off of the fluids means that the blood, which is mostly fluid content, needs to be in contact to the vessel walls so that the vessel walls have enough moisture and nourishment to keep them supple and elastic. And so as the blood volume starts to diminish from the fluid volume decreasing, we get blood that becomes thicker with increased viscosity, which puts more burden on the heart for circulation, right? And creates blood stasis, which we see as one of the main phenomenons from C19, right? With clotting and so forth. But it also creates a scenario where the vessel walls become less elastic and start to harden. And we see pulses that show up on the ROPI continuum, which is basically, from a Western standpoint, would be arteriosclerosis and hardening of the arteries, right? And so this phenomenon that takes place is becomes this sort of vicious cycle that becomes so it's further aggravating, and especially in populations of people who are more vulnerable. So you think about all the people with comorbidities to circulatory problems, cardiovascular disease, damp heat, high cholesterol, right, high blood pressure. These are the people who are succumbing the fastest to this diagnosis, right? Does that make sense? Am I going too far ahead?
Not at all. That's a really articulate pathomechanism that you just laid out very well for us all to really visualize all of this. And again, it's just like the ability of this medicine to treat things that are like completely confounding to other professions is like astounding every day to see how, you know, how much this could help.
Yeah.
And this whole systems thinking that has, you know, hundreds and thousands of years of experience, and then it's not being utilized.
No, absolutely.
So, it seems like exactly like what you just laid out. On top of that, people who have a genetic predisposition to cardiovascular issues that are really hard to treat, like people with POTS. I could really see this triggering a lot for people with that genetic predisposition.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so for those who aren't so familiar with the diagnosis and the symptoms, I want to just kind of run through maybe the main symptoms that it presents with, just in case you are, you know, you see this in your clinical practice. But, you know, the main thing really is a rapid heart rate, right? Tachycardia, right? That's in the name. And in particular, we're seeing tachycardia when there happens to be some change in position, right? So it's a postural movement. So you're lying down and then you sit up or stand up and all of a sudden your heart starts racing. Now, I talk about the liver before as a primary mechanism of this, and really because it presents itself as pretty much the epicenter of what's going on. And if you think about what the liver does from a Chinese medical perspective, right, from any perspective, really, it's a physiological process. So when you're sitting down and relaxing or lying down, all the blood that your body does not need for circulation and for skeletal movement, it pools back to your liver, right? So your liver stores the blood. We know that from Chinese medicine. And it's also, and that's one of the reasons why it's able to detoxify, because it has this abundant supply of blood. Interestingly too, it's also the only organ that can regenerate itself if a piece of it is resected, right? Because it has this abundant supply. So what happens though, when you stand up? That is actually specifically the liver's function to shunt blood from the quiescent stored state into the sinews and muscles and tendons, right? All the skeletal muscles to allow for physical movement. So if the liver is impaired, right? If it's chaotic, if it's empty, hypofunctioning in some way, or there is some type of diminishment in the resource of the blood itself, and this could be from, we see this a lot in women in particular, from blood loss, from menstrual cycles that are heavy in the monthly menstruation, which is one of the reasons why women tend to be more vulnerable to POTS than men. And it's also, I think, prior to C19, probably I would say 90% of the population of patients that I was seeing with POTS were female. And so this is a major dynamic of what's going on. And so we think about the liver shunting the blood to the extremities, right? To the skeletal muscles and the sinews and tendons, but also think about the head, right? In Chinese medicine, we call the head the fifth limb, right? It's the heart has to now move this blood with the liver support up against gravity. Okay. And we know the liver's domain over the brain itself, right? That's part of its channel trajectory. And so other symptoms of that are dizziness, feeling of lightheadedness. And of course, when that gets severe enough, fainting episodes, right? That's when it becomes even more dangerous. We also see things like headaches and visual disturbances, blurring of the eyes, loss of vision. And then we move into things like shaking and tremors and tics, right? These are all liver generated symptoms, liver wind from blood deficiency, right? And then we move into fatigue and weakness. We see things like insomnia and all the different hosts of sleep disorders, anxiety and panic disorder, poor circulation and cold hands and feet, right? That's like a very specific Dangui Sinikang, right, formula. These are all, so many of these things are within the realm of what the liver and in conjunction with the heart present from a Chinese medicine perspective, right? Feeling of heat in the head or flush or getting flushed, right? And you can think about the image in your head of what I described of the empty pulse, right? With this floating yang that is not anchored. There's no pulse down in the organ. Everything's floating up and away. And so you start to see the anxiety and panic, or what we call buntun or running piglet chi, right? Along with the flushing and the heat in the head, tightness in the chest, difficulty concentrating or staying focused, right? And in severe cases, what we start to see are people who get even dissociated, right? They're feeling as if they're not even in their own body, their limbs and body parts, you know, feel as if they're floating away from them. And then we also see different types of digestive symptoms with these people, nausea, bloating, constipation. And it's not because it impacts the digestive system as a primary impact. It's really more so because the liver, which regulates the directionality of all the different organ systems, impacts the spleen's ascension of qi and the stomach's descension, right? And so we start to see these symptoms manifest as well. And so you can, if you graph this out under all the particular phases, right? The, you know, heart and fire and liver, gallbladder and wood and so forth, you can find all of these symptoms fit into every single one of those organ components, because this really, like I said, it becomes a systemic problem, even though the epicenter is in the wood element and the fire element.
Thank you. And also, Jesse and Chrissy, feel free to.
So, Ross, I have a question here, especially with people who have comorbidities, a lot of dampness, a lot of, you know, overweight and weak spleen. If you're seeing this in patients, like, how would you further differentiate this from, you know, maybe if it's not so advanced where they have dizziness and tics, from, you know, spleen not being able to raise clear qi up to the head? when there's a lot of dampness and other spleen deficiency?
Yeah, well, so there's a few things. So you may find that the spleen is not able to raise the qi, but the question is, where's the root, right? So we have lots of branches off that come off of any given tree trunk and the roots that feed it. And so we don't want to get caught up in all the varied and disparate branches necessarily. We want to be able to pinpoint the major causative factors that are taking place here. And so you may find that there's dampness taking place and it's obstructing the middle burner and that's impairing the spleen's capacity. But really what we're going to find on the pulse is the primary culprits, right? And so are we finding an empty left middle position? Are we finding the inability of the liver to help the spleen spread and ascend its qi upward, right? So in the end, it's always going to come back to the objective, you know, or as objective as we can make it, the diagnostics in terms of the pulse diagnosis, because that's where it all comes together, right? So I taught a class the other day on storytelling and narratives, right? And the creation of how to kind of explain all these disparate pieces of people's symptoms back to them, right? Because in the end, symptoms are just like data points, right? We could have hundreds of data points that we are extracting from our patients within the course of our discussion and evaluation. But how do we narrate them together? How do we connect the dots so that they form a picture that makes sense, right? That mimics the actual lived reality of what this patient is. And we can create a nice elaborate story that doesn't resonate with our patient and doesn't bear out clinically when we prescribe our herbs or we do our acupuncture treatment. And so part of it is, clinical experience, and part of it is the diagnostics and understanding which findings to prioritize on the pulse and on the tongue and in the symptoms and in the history and so forth. But what I would, you know, with something like POTS, when you see the constellation of all the different symptoms and then you find the left middle position empty and you find pulses that are suggestive of liver invading spleen and you find pulses that are suggestive of dampness in having a root in the middle burner or the triple burner not integrated, then you start to create a more complete story that aligns with the origin of the patient's signs and symptoms. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
And I imagine too, cardiovascular family history. Go ahead.
Oh, I was actually, my mind following Jesse and his question, because we know in C19, there is an excess phlegm and fluid congestion, without a doubt, which can impede the mechanism of the liver being able to flow. So in treatment strategy, would you address both simultaneously, or would you modify to address the phlegm and dampness slightly, or would you first try to take a chunk out of the phlegm and dampness before trying to restore blood? What would be your approach?
So what you're asking is more so about an approach of treating the C19 presentation rather than the POTS presentation?
Well, that goes into my other question, but so why don't we start with that? Yes, that's what I was asking, the C19 creating the POTS. So in your experience, because you've been working with POTS for so long and you've seen it more in its traditional presentations, and now we have this huge population of the people who had this pestilence coming up with it, do you see a difference between this generation of patients and your traditional POTS patients?
I would say the short answer is not really. The main parameters and pathomechanisms are pretty much the same. My strategies for treating POTS you know, from years ago to what I'm seeing this particular year as a sequela to C19 is fairly identical. I mean, you may find that there are remnants of the C19 that need to be addressed as well. And that would really just mean that we're putting certain priorities and weighted, you know, dosages maybe to herbs that will be managing damp heat in the liver and the gallbladder and so on and so forth, or increasing herbs that have capacity to invigorate blood and manage blood stasis, because we see those things as well. And we also may need to, for some people, because when there's some of the endothelial tissue damage and some of the dryness that are showing up with things like, you may see, like, for example, the tics and the tremors, right, which is from the blood deficiency, or from, you know, from at least from a Zong Fu perspective, we can call that like a liver blood deficiency engendering wind. From a divergent meridian perspective, we may look at that as a stomach spleen divergent channel problem and look at it in terms of dehydration from the yin, from the thin fluids, from the jin. And so that would create some slightly different strategies in terms of acupuncture channel systems, and how that would correlate to the herbal formulas. But in the end, the mechanisms for the pots is the same. And so we just may need to look at some other kind of like tributaries that are coming in, contributing to some of the other signs and symptoms as remnants that are left over from the C19 diagnosis, you know?
Thank you for that. Do you want to talk a little bit maybe about what the pulse from heart shock? So okay, when these people are, you know, maybe their body was able to fight back its genetic tendencies before something like C19, the insult's just too great, and then it just propels someone into something that they, you know, like a POTS presentation. Where's the heart shock involved with that? Or are they two separate, or, you know, phenomenons? Are they related?
Yeah, well, but the answer is both, depending on the person, right? So what you may find is that, well, let me put it this way. When you're looking at the diagnosis of heart shock, there are specific pathognomonic findings on the pulse. One of the main things would be the rough vibration that we find systemically over the entire pulse. Now, interestingly, for those of us who practice the Shenhammer approach, when I've spoken with my colleagues, I think we all agree that I would say probably 60 to 70, if not more, percentage of patients have some aspect of rough vibrations over their entire pulse in varying degrees. So we rate the degree of this on in terms of 1 being minor and 5 being severe. So at some point, I would say probably about 70% of people has some aspect of rough vibration, which means that they've experienced some types of trauma in their lives that have risen to a particular level that it's obstructing the healing mechanisms that their body would intrinsically engage in. And so when you factor that into the amount of people who wind up contracting an epidemic disease, that becomes significant, right? So now we start to have a few overlaying features that we may want to have to kind of, you know, so we may have to peel back all the layers of each of these diagnoses and see how they are also interrelating and become enmeshed. The other part of this that's interesting is there are people, and I think it's a large population of people now. I mean, if you follow the news, which I tend to not, what you find is that there is an immense culture of fear that is going on right now, had been going on for over a year surrounding C19. That has engendered heart shock for people. It's engendered anxiety and panic disorder for lots of people. And then now you throw into that population of people actually getting sick and experiencing the signs and symptoms of what C19 offers. And so coming off of those diagnoses, people are feeling traumatized, right? They're very scared. They don't know, they see a lot of different things playing out, that this high, at least in the news, what you hear, you don't really hear about the 99.9% of people who contracted and survive. You hear about the, you know, the 0.05 who die, and that's all you hear about. And so it becomes a very frightening scenario. And so interestingly, and I detail this a little bit in my book, there is a formula that I recommend for people who have been traumatized by the particular by contracting an illness and then coming to the other side of it, and they wind up with extreme fatigue and fear, and they're unable to move beyond the particular diagnosis because they're kind of stuck in the pathology of what they experienced during the disease process. Interestingly, that formula is by Sun Tzu Miao, and it's called Wan Dan Tang. Why that's interesting here for us is because we know that that's a gallbladder formula, right? So that is a formula specifically that is looking, you could think about it, so it's to warm the gallbladder decoction, but it has lots of herbs that also deal with phlegm heat. And so as something to kind of be mindful of and think about for that population of heart shock patients who are post C19 diagnosis and having a hard time getting back to their everyday lives, that may be a nice formula to look at and perhaps modify with other strategies related to the particular individual. Because one of the things that formula offers is it kind of allows someone to kind of move past and being stuck in their illness, almost like it's almost like the Hun and the Po are kind of trapped within in this illness, right? And the phlegm is kind of is trapping the Po, so it cannot move into the current moment. It's staying into the past moment that they've experienced and they're suffering in. And so that's one major overlap that we can look at. But otherwise, when we're looking at specifically POTS patients as a sequela of C19, a lot of the strategies overlay very beautifully with the heart shock strategies. We're looking at astringing, right? We're building yin, we're building blood, we're astringing the vessels in the heart, we're promoting circulation, we're opening the orifices, we're clearing the blood circulation, got to invigorate. Because, of course, we see a lot of blood stasis taking place from this diagnosis, right? And one of the interesting things I want to mention about that too is we always in Chinese medicine think about and look at the dynamic of the law of signatures, right? And so when we're looking at something like C19, what makes C19 very unique is the spike protein, right? And what the spike protein does in particular is it creates a certain degree of damage and inflammation in the endothelial tissue, right? So we have a spike protein. On the pulse, we feel that spike as a choppy pulse, right? The choppy pulse is shaped specifically like multiple spikes. That's what it is, right? If you look at a picture of it in my book, you will see it's like a sawtooth, right? That's what it looks like. So it's not a surprise that a choppy pulse is one of the main findings we see along with the left middle position being empty. But then we also now think about treatments. And so what does that mean in terms of treatments? One of the main herbs in the literature that has been shown to deal with the sequela of this blood stasis and the inflammation has been, the supplement berberine, right? Which comes from, the barberry, right? And if you look at what that looks like in nature, it's full of thorns and spikes, right? You look at the leaf of huanglian, right? Because berberine's in huanglian, it's in huangbai, it's in huangqin, right? So we see these dynamics take place. And we also see that these particular supplements and active ingredients and herbs all resonate to the liver gallbladder, right? And so again, it's not really a huge surprise.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. And Jesse?
Yeah, Ross, I'm just wondering if you can maybe step back and define a couple terms. So you talked about choppy being sort of like the sawtooth wave. And then you also talked about rough. And, you know, when I think of choppy, I think of the descriptor of rough. And I'm just wondering if you see those as the same thing or if you differentiate them further.
Yeah, they're very different and distinct. Although, you know, it does take a bit of training to be able to perceive the differences of this. But so imagine, I'm trying to think of the best way to explain it. I mean, the descriptions of these are in the textbooks and in, you know, all the Schenhammer Pulse books and the handbooks and so forth. But quickly, when we're looking at a choppy pulse, basically imagine the point of those, it's like a triangle, right? Those edges are very sharp. Right. So there's a very fine tip point to a choppy pulse. A rough vibration is a combination of a rough pulse and a vibrating pulse. So a rough pulse is going to feel similar in many ways to a choppy pulse, except the apex of the wave, right, where a choppy is very sharp, the rough is a little more rounded than that. Okay, so it has more of, and then when you throw in the vibration, it feels like a buzzing on the fingertip, where the choppy pulse feels more like a grating. And there's also, you know, it gets more complicated even than that, of course, because besides the rough vibration, then we also have smooth vibrations. And smooth vibration feels like a tickling sensation on the fingertip, where the rough sensation is more of a buzzing and the choppy pulse is more of a grating sensation. And the way of thinking about the difference between a rough and a smooth is really that what we're talking about is the speed and of the oscillation of the waveform, right? So basically the waveform in a smooth vibration is much closer together, the tips of the wave, where the rough, it's slightly more separated and so it has a slightly different feel to it. And then choppy is just that it's sharper on the edge.
You were saying you were recommending some Schenhammer books, and I'm not sure. I have seen some diagrams with Schenhammer pulses where it's actually made into visual.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. I have them in my book, and they're also in the, you know, the handbooks and Dr. Hammer's big textbook. But the handbook actually has the most updated versions of those images, as does my book. But yeah, I don't have all of them.
What's the name of your book for people who are interested?
Yeah, my book is called Heart Shock. So it the main title is Heart Shock, and then it says Diagnosis and Treatment of Trauma with Schenhammer and Classical Chinese Medicine.
And where can they get it?
That's you can find that on Amazon or Singing Dragon's website.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, and then the other, the handbook of Dr. Hammer's, which a number of us certified teachers each took a few chapters and basically took the massive 800-page Chinese pulse diagnosis book and consolidated and edited it into a smaller, more user-friendly version. So that's called Handbook of Contemporary Chinese Pulse Diagnosis. So that has a lot of great images of like all the different pulse qualities, at least the ones that can be illustrated.
That sounds a lot more convenient for those of us who have a large backup of our to read list.
Yeah,
that we don't have to look through the 800 pages.
Totally.
Do you want to? So Ross is a Taoist priest, right? And is there anything you can, for those, like, I know describing a pulse is a little bit hard, but you're really good at illustrating, like, pathomechanisms. Is there, like, a way that we can visualize, like, heart shock trauma? Like, one of my teachers, Brenda Hood, used to speak with us a lot about, you know, what happens to the heart when this heart spirit almost leaves the body and then it tries to come back in, but, you know... It gets. Is there any way that you kind of visualize that sort of heart trauma that might help people be able to recognize it when their patient comes in?
Yeah. Well, you know, for you, I think so. wherever you're sitting right now, right? I'm sitting in my office at my desk, and imagine that you are just kind of sitting alone by yourself. Maybe your eyes are closed, it's dark, you're relaxing. And then imagine like a gunshot happens right behind you, right?
Oh, that happened to me. I was sleeping one night and I lived right next to a lake, and some crazy person shot like several rounds into the lake, which was like feet away from my bed.
Wow. Yeah. 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 I mean, that's significant, right? So
it was awful.
So this is what happens here, is this kind of emotional shock, and it could be physical shock or emotional shock, and just being mindful that every type of physical shock, or let's say a trauma that rises to the level of heart shock, will also have the emotional correlate to it, right? And so what we have to recognize is that with these traumas, the heart, everything, you know, the whole body recoils, right? So you can imagine when you experience something, your whole body will kind of like recoil and tighten up, and kind of like you almost like will move intrinsically into almost like a, try to mimic a fetal position. And this is basically the pericardium evoking protective measures, right? It creates a degree of vasoconstriction from the peripheral circulation, and also an emptying of the heart yin in its attempt to divert yin and blood to the internal organs to protect oneself, right? The problem is that as that happens, adrenaline kicks in and the fight or flight mechanisms all emerge, and the heart rate now starts to elevate. And so when that happens, what you find is that because, and this is in vulnerable people, or I mean, and then there are, even in the strongest of us, there's always some type of trauma or shock or intervention that will override even the strongest individual's protective measures. But at that point, there's insufficient yin and blood to contain the effervescent yang. And so it's like all of a sudden, you know, have you ever seen like, you know, wild horses and something startles them? They just go. They're just gone. They take off and then try to rein that back in, right? And so without the intrinsic capacities of the fire phase, right, pericardium, small intestine, triple burner integration, then the heart yang just goes off and it's unable to be contained. And then you wind up with a very rapid heart rate, which is one of the main findings that we see with heart shock. And if that heart rate does not return to its normal range, and I have charts in my book describing what those ranges should be, that is a very determinative factor of whether or not someone is going to experience heart shock. So, and this is, you know, this is talked about in my book. I go through this in a lot of detail in narrative form. And I'm, you know, I cite a lot of different other authors and experts on trauma. But this really is one of the main aspects. If your heart rate does not return to normal, then you wind up into the realm of the PTSD and dealing with heart shock scenario that becomes a whole block to treatment and a systemic problem that needs to be unwound by some type of intervention, right? And so there's multiple strategies also that I detail in there, and some of which are nourishing the heart yin and invigorating the blood and nourishing blood potentially if there's deficiency, calming the nervous system, you know, resetting the adrenals and anchoring kidney yang. And there's some there's a whole host of other things that go into opening the orifices. And so I break it down into primary strategies, secondary strategies, and tertiary strategies depending on the individual and what's happening. But these are the main dynamics. And now imagine that you have this patient coming into you years later, and how do you figure out that this person has had a trauma that you need to unwind for them, or that it's relating and contributing to their problems. And so I'm sure everyone has had the experience of being in a parking lot with cars, and many of these cars are parked, but they're still maybe turned on, right? The ignition is still on. And most cars, when they're turned on, are completely silent, right? You don't hear anything. But every now and again, you may see an older car or a car that's been beat up a little bit that has a strong idle, and it's revving, right? You hear that all the time, right? That is the rough vibration analogy that you're picking up when you're feeling and palpating their pulse. And that is what's going on internally in their nervous system that does not know how to relax. Even when they're sleeping, they're still depleting reserves, burning the oil, right? Depleting reserves. And so, you know, these are the kinds of things to think about. You know, there's also, you know, there's tons of pulse qualities that are suggestive of it. There's things that show up on the complexion, you know, in terms of, I detail all of that. There's things that show up, you know, on palm diagnosis, on abdominal diagnosis, under the mucosal lid of the lower eyelid. So there's so many ways of looking at it and building up all the data points to make a story that is resonant with the patient's lived experience. But these are some of the main metaphors that you would look for. That revving of the nervous system, the inability to shut things back down. And so, you know, so it's not uncommon to find someone who can't sleep very well, either can't fall asleep, or they fall asleep and they wake up all the time, back and forth, tossing and turning, or they wake up and they're up for at least a half hour or an hour or more before they can fall back asleep, or the person who wakes up and can't fall back asleep, right? These are all diagnostic of very specific aspects of the trauma and particular humors of the heart, right? So some of those are would be suggestive of heart qi deficiency. Other of those signs are heart blood deficiency. So some of them show blood stagnation in the heart. Some of them show liver fire and so forth. So, you know, these are all the details of that are kind of in the, you know, in the book.
Is that sort of, is trauma like, I guess maybe a severe enough trauma, but could cause like valve problems for a heart? Have you ever seen that?
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, that's a common finding. So we see and we diagnose that also on Shenhammer. There's a pulse position. Actually, there's a pulse position for every single heart valve. So we can, you know, the mitral valve is the easiest one to find and perceive pulse qualities. But, you know, I've been able to feel someone's pulse and tell them that they're, you know, like the pulmonary valve is prolapsed or whatever, you know, because there's specific sensations and locations within the left distal pulse that will give you that information. But that's a common finding. You know, mitral valve prolapse, even in Western medicine, they have recognized the association of mitral valve prolapse to anxiety and panic disorder.
I'm guessing that's one of the most common ones too, then.
It is, for sure.
Yeah. Wow.
So I'm glad that you mentioned the adrenals, because in the more functional medicine approach, they're going to look at that regulation of the blood pressure relating to the adrenals, which that's where I had always gone when I saw this lightheaded and dizziness. And then I don't mix my medicine, so I'd keep my Chinese. So if it was, you know, liver blood deficiency or whatever, I would address that. But we also know that the adrenals are fried due to lots of stress. And here in Los Angeles, we don't necessarily jump when we hear a gunshot. You know, it's kind of normal. for real. But I think I see a lot of adrenal fatigue and this fry out of the nervous system because we're in a constant low level place of stress. So yeah. Can you talk about your approach taking the adrenal complex into the POTS treatments?
Yeah, for sure. And let me first maybe start by defining the nervous system, right? Because this is one of these really weird things that we are Western people, but we practice Chinese medicine and we're using terms like nervous system. And like, what on earth does that even mean from a Chinese medical perspective, right? You know, Dr. Shen talked about the nervous system all the time. And, you know, he sort of tried to define it a little bit, and he would talk about it as the taiyang, or the fastest moving energies in the body, right? So we can see that as wei qi and the taiyang, and how it deals with the broadest, you know, muscle channels, bladder and small intestine, and so forth. But there's a lot that goes into this understanding of the nervous system. And, you know, I spend a lot of time in certain classes, like at least 30 to 40 minutes detailing slides about what the nervous system is from this perspective. But in a nutshell, if we look at and we take as a starting point what Dr. Shen talks about in terms of the Taiyang, we can see the Taiyang as the bladder and small intestine, and as the movement of Wei Qi out to the exterior and how it protects the interior domain as it communicates back and forth. However, there's a reliance of the Taiyang on its counterpart, the Shaoyin. Because the Shaoyin is really, so when you look at the kidneys are the structure. It's the parenchymal tissue that makes up the nervous system itself, right? So we're looking at the brain, we're looking at the spinal column. And so we have to understand it from that perspective. So you can't talk about Taiyang as the function without talking about the source, right, of the Shaoyin. And that includes the heart as well. And that heart becomes really important in terms of the Shaoyin component, because the nervous system is directly related to the mind, right? And how we perceive things and how we, you know, the stress that comes in and out and how the mind takes that, and how anxiety and panic and all those things are intimately connected. So it's hard to really talk about the nervous system without talking about the mind and not talking about the heart and the Shaoyin kidney and its relationship in terms of its source of the yang qi that converts into the wei qi dynamics that protect us on the Taiyang level through bladder and small intestine. However, when you look at Dr. Shen's herbal formulas for the nervous system, they primarily impact the liver from a Zhang Fu perspective when you break them down, which is interesting. And if we think about the liver's role in this, we would say that the liver, as Jue Yin, is the mediator between the water below in the north and the fire above in the south, right? So if we look at, you know, like we see that our kind of circle of life where we have Taiyang up top and Shaoyin below, and we can mix in Jue Yin, Shaoyang, and Yang Ming, we look at that eastern side of the wheel as Jue Yin kind of opening, moving things from that quiescent state of the Shaoyin, which we talked about in terms of its blood supply and how it moves the blood out to the sinew channels, right? So this is the correlate to that. So it's going to be acting with Shaoyang as sort of that kind of ministerial fire aspect to kind of communicate the two. And so the nervous system herbal formulas Dr. Shen offers have a lot to do with liver functioning. When you look at some of his other formulas, we start to see a lot of differing dynamics that resonate more towards like things like divergent channels and sinew channels. And it, you know, this is beyond maybe our discussion today, but it's just, if I talk about it in the book, if you're interested to kind of go and look at that. But so this is really, really important. When you look at the same wheel of life or circle of life with these dynamics, I can't help but think about something that, you know, a post that my wife made the other day. She kind of discussed the impact of C19 and interestingly talked about the dynamics of vitamin D3 and melatonin, right? So vitamin D3 as like this pure, you know, we activate this from the sunlight, right? So the pure yang up in the Taiyang area, right, where we kind of absorb from the sun and our body creates this, and then down. And so we have D3 being created, right, from optimal exposure to sun, right, 12 noon fire. And then we have melatonin as a kind of a corresponding hormone that balances this off at the midnight hour, right? But and we know that the impact of D3 and melatonin, if those levels are in proper places, one cannot have a cytokine storm, right? So one is buffered and protected from cytokine storm. So we know the importance of these two. But then how do we communicate this? How do we create the final circuitry? And that's done via Jue Yin. And it's done, and we know, and I talked about this in my class yesterday, as you can remember, but we know that when someone gets sick, gets a C19 infection or gets fever, people tend to reach towards Tylenol, one of the worst things you can do, right? Because Tylenol depletes glutathione levels, and glutathione levels are responsible for the detoxification in the liver, right? And then if we have diminished glutathione, then we have a higher level of toxicity and more susceptibility and vulnerability to succumb to the illness. Interesting that in order for D3 to get synthesized and activated, it requires adequate levels of glutathione, right? So we can see this combination, how it's moving through this relationship constantly. And this is the same thing as when we're talking about the nervous system, because it's the exact correlate that takes place. It's the same energetic loop and cycle that we're looking at. In order for Shaoyin to reach Taiyang, we need Zhuayin and Shaoyang to do it. We need the help of those systems. And that's where the liver and the gallbladder become so important. And so when we're looking at POTS, the Zhuayin and Shaoyang are crucial in creating the movement of this cycle. And then we need to anchor, right? Because the kidney yang needs to be anchored. And so we do that with, you know, I mean, I showed a lot of formulas yesterday in the POTS class, you know, but one of the simple ones that just demonstrates this process is Dangui Sinitang with Wu Zhuyu and Shengjiang, right? So Dangui Sinijia Wu Zhuyu Shengjiang Tang. And so it basically describes this movement that opens up the liver, creates the circulatory dynamic that communicates the Shaoyin up to the Taiyang, but also allows for Yang Ming to bring things back down and anchor. And then I always put other things into a formula. So I'm always adding, I tend to add in a lot of astringent herbs, things like Xuanzaren and so forth, as well as some minerals and things, especially with POTS patients, because especially when the empty pulse is, you know, a moderate to severe level, we need things like, you know, Digesure and, you know, sort of the hematite and so forth. And because we need or like Longu Muli, things that are going to really anchor and build and stringe, Wuweza, Shanjuyu, and so forth. So these are the dynamics that bring things back down. And I also tend to use a lot of Fuzi, you know, in that as well, with things like Sharen and to kind of anchor and bring the kidney yang back down to where it needs to be, rooted into the lower abdomen.
Thank you. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
Sure.
Do you want to talk about, maybe illustrate a patient of yours, if you feel comfortable doing that, or maybe some overlap in acupuncture channels and points that you might be seeing, or common like patterns that you notice yourself deploying clinically when you're treating patients with POTS and heart shock?
Well, I mean, there's so many, right? I mean, so yesterday in my class, I went through all the channel systems and described the dynamics of the sinew channels and went through each individual sinew channel and then the low vessels and went through each individual low vessel so people could understand the thought process, why one would choose, you know, one channel system over another, and then the virtue of the particular channel within that system. So I mean, I think people may find it more helpful to see the fuller discussion and try and do that too quickly. But I will just say, maybe from a primary channel perspective, a few of my go-to points, because there's a few things I think that time and time again prove themselves to be effective, and not just like effective over the long term, but effective immediately, right? So when someone comes in as a POTS patient and they're dealing with, you know, headache, dizziness, tachycardia, and all these things, and I find that left middle position empty, the first thing I do, the first point I needle, is a point. It doesn't have a name, and it's I can't remember if it's described in the Suwen or the Lingshu, but it's 3 Sun lateral to Ren 12, and it's right on the border. Basically, if you slide down the rib cage all the way towards where you would find, you know, it's like it creates like a little bit of a notch. And you can just go to REN 12 and go over and kind of like palpate for the little notch in the rib. And so that's the point. But it has to be needled in a particular way to be effective. And because think about what we're doing here from, again, you want to visualize the empty pulse, right? Visualize this floating yang and a lack of root below at the organ depth. And so what you do at this point is you needle it to the wei level, right? So you can put it in a little bit and gather some qi with some kind of rotation type of technique. And when you get a good sensation of qi at the needle, you drive it down deep into the yuan level. Okay. And then you kind of like, so you're taking that wei qi that's all chaotic up at the exterior, and you're depositing it back down into the yuan level. And then go back and feel the left middle position, and it should not be empty anymore, right? You should find that that pulse has rooted itself, and you can palpate all the depths of the pulse. Now, that does not mean that one treatment is gonna say when the needle comes out, next time you see this person, that they're all better and they're not going to have an empty pulse. They may, and they may have that pulse that still lingers for a while, but the more you do this, the longer that impact will last, and eventually that empty pulse will resolve. Especially, it'll happen much faster, of course, if you're doing herbal formulas in the meantime between treatments, whether and maybe even, you know, dietary changes, particular types of you know, qigong, essential oils used and massaged into the points that resonate specifically to those energetics, and so forth. So that is probably my biggest go-to point. That if you forget everything else except that, like you'll probably still have some nice success with the patient. And then usually from there, I will needle liver 3 deeply and connect that through and through to kidney 1. Right? So kidney 1, we want to make sure we're anchoring that all the way down into the kidney aspect and the UN level.
Well, sorry. Very cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's so many possible points and treatments that I don't want to, I think it might not, the disservice in going through that, I think, is that it becomes protocol, and I don't really like it to be protocol because it's never that. And I know you're not suggesting that it is, but I think in service of understanding the dynamics of what's happening, it may be best to kind of, you know, do the Healthy Seminars course and get a fuller perspective on what those channels offer and why they may be appropriate in any given patient interaction.
Right. Yeah. And just for everyone who might not have heard before, Ross recently did a Healthy Seminar on this, and Lorne offered 20% off of that with the code Clubhouse20. Which expires on the 20th. So if you're going to take this class, I would recommend you do that soon, or at least get it in there, because you can, I think you have access. Well, I haven't done a Healthy Seminar recently.
So I think they have access for like a year.
Yeah, that was my understanding of when I did one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a 3-hour course. So it's like, I think it was 3 PDAs, and I think it was listing for like $75. So, you know, so that's about $60, I guess. Yeah.
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 Gosh.
Yeah.
Take the course, people.
Okay, so you just said something that triggered a question. So I'm still on telemedicine, and I've really had to get creative with my treatment strategies, which has actually been extremely successful. I'm like, do I even need a clinic? But you just talked about Qigong practices, and given that most of the people here on the panel are really into spirituality, do you want to talk about that and share with us what you would do with these patients in regards to at-home exercises and Qigong?
Sure. You know, Qigong is, there's so many different kinds of Qigong that I tend to not make anything complicated with patients in that regard. You know, typically in terms of Qigong, I will show them some very simple anchoring, you know, fire, water, types of Qigong movements. And for POTS patients, you generally don't want them standing while they're doing this because, you know, depending on the severity of the POTS, they will tend to get a little lightheaded and dizzy, and you don't want to create any vulnerability or possibility for falling or any type of injury that's going to come back, you know, and say, why on earth did you have me do a standing Qigong when you know I'm dizzy, right? So generally it would be sitting down in a chair, even ideally recumbent, right? Just like, you know, they recommend recumbent bike as terms of gentle exercise. You can require, I mean, or just suggest some type of recumbent posture, or even lying down completely, you know. So that's a very simple thing to do. And, you know, it's hard for me to describe the Qigong to you while we're not visually seeing each other. But, you know, anything that's going to allow for moving and connecting heart and kidneys, right? That's going to be the simplest, easiest way. Even just general basic meditation where someone is focusing their intention on their lower abdomen, the lower dantian, you know. So I had a patient of mine who came in actually Friday. I hadn't seen her in about 10 years. I treated her 10 years ago. She has she had very severe SVTs. And so her heart rate would go up into like the 200s. And, you know, she was hospitalized tons of different times. And so I treated her 2 to 3 times a week for, I'd say, about 6 months or maybe even longer. And so she hasn't had an SVT in 10 years, except that she got C19 a couple of months ago, and then all of a sudden started getting SVTs again. And so I saw her on telemedicine quickly when she had C19, gave her herbal formula, and she did well, got better. And then she was just able to come in on Friday, and I put some, you know, she didn't want to lie down flat because it was creating some of that dynamic. So we had her a little bit inclined on the table, and I started putting some needles in, and she started to notice that her heart rate was getting a little fast. So I, of course, stimulated that 0.3 sun lateral to REN 12. And I asked her to start doing a breathing technique where she was kind of closing her eyes and kind of turning her vision inwards and trying to trace internally from the behind her eyes down behind her heart, her abdomen, into the area just below the umbilicus, and to breathe slowly and just to keep that visualization. And within about 30 seconds to a minute, her heart rate started slowing down and she started feeling better. And then I left the room and came back, you know, 25 minutes later or so, and, you know, it hadn't reasserted. She was totally fine. She tried to maintain that meditation throughout the course of the treatment and just felt great afterwards, you know. So it could be something, you know, just that simple. One of the other things that I really like as well is that while patients are sitting down in a chair, is to do some type of grounding or earthing, you know, getting that bare feet onto the ground, touch back to the electrical charge of the earth, right? It's very grounding, and it helps kind of anchor those pulses and create some more stability for them.
And also, speaking of kidney one, that's great because that's where, you know, we receive qi from the earth, and kidney one's right there. And so oftentimes I will do moxa on kidney one, particularly mm-hmm. on the right side.
Great.
And then also, I tell people during the winter to stick their hands into dirt if it's too cold out, that at least mm-hmm. they get that sort of contact with the earth.
Yeah, totally. And there's also, you know, they sell grounding pads, and there's a whole, like, you know, there's a whole movement now with that. Like, you can buy sheets on your bed that are grounding sheets and all sorts of fun, you know, pillows and blankets and so forth.
Yeah. Does it seem like a good time to open up to questions from the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. Please. Thanks, everyone, for sticking around.
Yeah, I mean, this has been
great. I'm just blabbering away.
No, this has been really, really helpful, and I really appreciate getting to experience your thought processes and clinical reasonings and get, you know, more information about your background. And you've been in practice for how many years now, Ross?
I've been in practice just over 20 years.
Yeah. Well, we all get to benefit from that, so thank you. If anyone has any questions, feel free to hit the little thing. Don't hit leave quietly. hit the hand thing beside that. It has like a little hand with like a paper behind it. I don't know. If you have any questions for Ross. And then we'll pull you up onto the stage and you can ask your question. This is for licensed acupuncturists, and it is being recorded, may or may not be posted, but it is being recorded, so definitely be mindful about that. So while we wait for that, what about the Chong Mai?
Mm-hmm.
Are you finding that you're utilizing this for... And by the way, just for people who might not be familiar with dysautonomia, POTS is a form of dysautonomia. Ross spoke about some of the symptoms before, but to give you an understanding, like just how much the variances with their heart rate change when they change positions, I think the minimum is like 30 beats per minute and up. So,
it's interesting.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that in the Shenhammer pulse system, mm-hmm. this is a test that we do for every patient on the initial visit. So after when the patient first sits down across from us, we take their rate and we note their rhythm, and then we go into the whole evaluation. Could take, you know, depending on what we do, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, a half hour, depending on the complexity. After that, we take the rate again, and then we ask them to stand up and swing their arm 10 times as fast as they can. And then we take the rate again. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking for is the norm. And I go through this in detail in my book, but the normal increase is roughly around 12 to 15 beats per minute. And there's three things that can happen outside of that range. One is that someone's heart rate doesn't quite make it up into that 12 to 15. And that would be a heart qi deficiency.
Yeah.
And depending on how far out of the range, the more severe. Someone's heart rate can actually drop below their resting heart rate, and that's extremely dangerous. That's heart yang deficiency. Yeah, I just had a patient come in with that a couple of weeks ago. Very, very scary. So that was a heart yang deficiency. This was a 28-year-old patient who just had heart attacks and has a pacemaker. And on the other side, you have someone whose heart rate can go above that 12 to 15, and the higher above that range, the more significant that is, and that's a heart blood deficiency. Right. So someone whose heart rate is going 30 and above is moving into this kind of like moderate to severe heart blood deficiency. I've had people who jumped up 40, 50 beats.
Yeah.
These are very, very, very severe cases of heart blood deficiency. But you can see the correlation of that to POTS. Right. I mean, that is specifically the liver not sending enough blood out to the extremities and the heart having to pump so ridiculously fast to try and get that diminished volume of blood through the system, right? But of course, what you don't get is proper filling time, right? So you get preload failure and you don't get enough blood entering into the chambers, and that becomes a very dangerous scenario.
So your heart's beating like crazy to try to make up for the fact that it doesn't have enough blood to circulate.
Right.
And so you're maybe it's probably even below 30 beats per minute, but you know, that's the state of it where it is, because a lot of people don't even get diagnosed for POTS, even the Western medical system, even though, like Ross said, it's been around in some form that they've been aware of since 1993. But there's that, and they have a lot of problems like with electrolytes, and they always have to make sure that they have access to like salt, and they have like weird feel. A lot of these patients, not all of them, will have weird feelings in their extremities. So like they'll have to stamp their legs down to kind of return to a feeling of normalcy. They often will get lightheaded. They have to keep food on them at all times. A lot of them, most of them right now seem to be women. I think, like Ross had mentioned, a lot of them are light skin, light hair, and light eyes. But I mean, that just could be, you know, also, you know, not being diagnosed properly across all skin colors too. So I wouldn't necessarily hang my head on that. But Am I missing any of them? Western medical, just for, because your patients could be coming into you and not have a diagnosis.
Right. Yeah. Very, very often.
And they'll have to be seen by even cardiologists. Normal cardiologists might not even be good enough. They need actual POTS specific.
Yeah. There's a very poor understanding of this disorder.
Yeah. And they do a tilt table test for, that's how they do that part of it.
I was just going to say really quickly that with the activists I'm working with, this is totally undiagnosed. And one of them was prescribed over 8 grams of salt a day from a POT specialist. So she can't really get it in, but she said it does really help her. And then in regards to what Kristen just said about lighter skin people being diagnosed, that's actually something we're really, really working on, which is that there is a lot of, I'm just going to say it, there's a lot of inherent racism in the medical system and poor access to healthcare. So this is something that we're actually forming committees to reach out to the ME/CFS and long C19 communities to identify and help them get handouts and education on how to educate their doctors, because they're not being properly diagnosed. Some of them are being drug tested every time they go in. And then they're also just doing the defunct, oh, it's anxiety diagnosis, which is awful. So it's a real issue.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. I suspect that that could probably be an issue with that.
Just one thing I want to just mention about that too, about the salt aspect of what you're talking about. Salt pills and such are one of the most common remedies that the doctors will push. And, it's also being mindful that, most of those are just like NaCl, right? Fairly toxic, especially in large doses. And we know, for me, I recommend that if the people are going to be adding salt to their stuff, it should be sea salt. Also, it mimics the chemical constituent of blood, and there's a lot of things where NaCl in and of itself is not really going to do that. And also, when you're looking at that kind of level of salt over a period of time, we know what that does. Too much salt is going to impact the blood, and it's going to impact also the kidneys and the bones as well, weakening them. And so that further kind of creates this issue that winds up becoming a vicious cycle. So, that tends to not be really the best approach to monitoring a condition like this.
Thank you. Yes, Anne is up on the stage here. Did you have a question?
Thank you, guys. I wanted to thank you, Kristen, for letting me in, first of all, and all the speakers, but in particular, Ross. I have been sitting here fascinated listening to all of this as a TCM student, but also as a nurse and also as a POTS, apparently. I'm 54 now, probably started with POTS in like maybe eighth grade or so, but it was intermittent and it was always one of those things where I could convert it on my own until basically this last year. And long story short, I was hospitalized very recently for a scare where we couldn't get it to convert. Now I'm wearing a 30-day monitor. I'm also a TCM student, by the way, so I'm sitting here with my book with the Wendon Tong and listening to all of this. And I think my wish is that we were 50 years in the future and your expertise could be coupled with the cardiologists, especially the electrophysiology cardiologists, where you are working hand in hand together, because I can see the benefits of both. But that isn't happening and that's not going to happen. So my question is, when you are talking with an open-minded, I'm fortunate to have an open-minded electrophysiologist, cardiologist, who is suggesting ablation, which I'm sure you must be familiar with, what are your thoughts on herbal remedies as opposed to ablation, and or from the point of view of ablation as a, it seems to be curative for a lot of people, and then to take this and spin it just a little bit further, let's look at the fascia throughout the entire system, especially when you're talking about needling into the middle and then down to the deep and coming back up, connecting. I suspect strongly that the fascia is the missing piece. We're holding emotion. So like, let's go back to my eighth grade. You know, there's a lot of trauma that's back there, and you pull that, you know, on top of it into the COVID crisis where I have been as a nurse locally in an area where we have anti-maskers galore and anti-vaxxers and all of the trauma that we create. So I've been trying to be a calm voice for our local community. It literally is a gathering spot that we have over 1,000 people in it now, but they come there for actual factual information as opposed to conspiracy theory. And, you know, we literally have professors from the local university hanging out there. The long story short, if that's even possible, is do you feel like this POTS has increased because of COVID, and how do I gently interject that with an electrophysiologist who is going to have a healthy amount of skepticism of TCM, because that's, you know, our reality, and help to guide them? Would you like, could I give him your email, for example, just so he could talk with you about what you have experienced? Because I think it would be so valuable going forward for so many people. I'm sorry, it's all these thoughts are trying to come out at once. And I just really appreciate everything that I've learned tonight. And no matter what you say, I have appreciated it. So thank you. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for your question. It's a difficult one to answer, really. I mean, I have spoken with cardiologists. I'm always open to speaking with cardiologists. And if people are open and receptive to understanding the Chinese medical paradigm, then that's a wonderful thing. It is sometimes a challenging thing to translate into a Western doctor's wheelhouse. I mean, Chinese medicine is the broader paradigm, and everything within Western medicine should be able to be explained within Chinese medicine. But it's not always the same when you kind of go back the other way. It's more reductionist, and it doesn't always allow for some of these understandings to take place. I think the short answer is yes. I'm always open to it. I don't always find it so helpful. I think the most helpful thing when looking at trying to, I don't want to use the word convert a doctor, but basically to elucidate our paradigm or our understanding of something, is the necessity is that practitioners are versed in it, that practitioners treat their patients well, that their patients go and they report their experiences to their doctors. And that is where we see change. Every doctor that I've had a conversation with, I think, has been because of a patient's success that is touting what I've done. It doesn't usually happen any other way. And, you know, I do just want to touch on one of the things you said, not to be controversial in any way, but, you know, this understanding and the labeling of things like conspiracy theory, or the labeling of disparate approaches and understandings and perspectives, I think is part of the problem in the Western medical community for opening up dialogue, because there's such an ease in throwing words like that around. What doctor wants to be touting Chinese medicine herbal formula to their patients when they can't find any type of research study that they can show their peers? It puts them in a very vulnerable position. And I think it's part and parcel of the culture that we're living in that is not allowing open dialogue to take place in the manner in which I think it should. And so we see this being significantly highlighted over this past year with C19 and all the very disparate approaches. You know, I can go tell a doctor that I've treated tons of COVID patients, C19 patients, and have done that very successfully. What is that going to mean if I didn't use the approach that a West, are they going to try and start sending me patients? Probably not. You know, there's a significant resistance and reluctance that is at the heart of the problem. And there's an issue with open dialogue not being allowed to take place that really is a problem that hopefully conversations like this and Clubhouse and these types of discussions will start to remedy in some small way and hopefully emerge into a bigger, larger discussion.
I really appreciate that. And I take your point. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the question.
Thank you, Anne, for coming up. And I appreciate you, you know, sharing your experience and, you know, I can't imagine how difficult it must be to have to work as a Western medical provider as well in this time too. So thank you very much for your question. And we have Samantha. And just a reminder, this is being recorded. So go ahead. And do you have a question?
Yeah. Hi there. My name is Samantha Berg. I'm actually a five element acupuncturist, and what I have been studying for, well, I've been an acupuncturist for about 20 years, and I graduated from what used to be Thai Sophia. And the word, I'm just curious, two things. One is a little bit of a case study, but one is just a, just curious if Ross thinks that the reason that Worsley put the liver 14 at the tip of the 10th rib, is that close to the point that you're talking about, that you use three sun lateral to run 12?
Yeah, it is. You know, the difference is, well, there's different ways of needling that that point, right? So sometimes what we do is we angle it under the rib cage and almost like tap into the area where the liver is. In this particular scenario, you know, I'm suggesting it be needled perpendicularly, but yeah, I think it is the same point, and I generally find it in that same way.
Yeah, it's interesting to me why sometimes those, just it happens to be a place where those points are so far apart. So the sixth intercostal space versus the tip of the 10th rib. And I've always wondered why that was. A lot of the points are kind of, you know, near each other, but that particular point is so far away. So that, you just explained a 20-year mystery to me. So that's great. and then the other question I have, and I'm going to try to make this as brief as possible, but this is, my husband actually has POTS and dysautonomia relating to a failed root canal that he had this summer. And he had a root canal that led to a deep infection in his jaw, and then all these secondary stealth pathogens came in. But the first thing that came up when the infection took off in his jaw, I think he already had an infection there, and then the endodontist missed a fourth canal in the tooth, and it just like, you know, it just went crazy. But the first thing that happened was insomnia. And he did, and the heart racing. So everything that you're talking about, and what happened in Western medicine was that it got misdiagnosed because an MRI showed a disc at T5-6 pressing on the cardiac accelerator. So they said, oh, this is a disc pressing on a sympathetic nerve bundle. And when he changes positions, it's causing his sympathetic nervous system to go. And he definitely looked sympathetic dominant at the time. But, you know, like I was treating him with acupuncture. We were using five element Japanese stuff, you know, throwing herbs at him. We were trying everything. And he basically didn't sleep for almost 6 weeks. And so that's part of why his immune system got thrashed and all the other stealth pathogens came in. And now we finally got to an immunology expert in North Carolina. And one of the things that he said about the racing heart, and this is where I'm just curious how you would see this from a Chinese medicine standpoint, one. And then second, if I see it again, what are your thoughts on how to treat it? Because I have another patient right now is looking like she might be in the same boat. But the immunologist said, and I think it's called the LDH level, it's supposed to be 140 and not go below that. And my husband's was like 107. And he said, for every single tick below 140, that would be an incident of the body waking up. And so in my husband's case, it was like almost 30 times a night. And the way he described it was the brain is the only organ that doesn't store sugar. So at first the brain tries to wake you up with a hit of cortisol. So that's sounding a little bit more kidney-like. And then if that doesn't work to get more sugar, because the brain literally perceives itself as starving, that it hits the body with a shot of adrenaline. And that's what was happening. He was waking up in a panic with a racing pulse, and we couldn't regulate his pulse. So, and that happened, literally that went on for like 5 or 6 weeks until we finally got to a chiropractor and we were getting some results. But I'm just curious, when you see that level of acute insomnia going on, any thoughts on like how you would approach that? Or is it the same? Would you use that point? We had no, I mean, literally I was throwing everything I had at him and treating him 24/7 and couldn't get it to switch.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tricky scenario. So, you know, first is I wanted to just touch on, of course, you know, that T5, mm-hmm. That's not relevant, right? I mean, of course it's right. Relevant. It's the level of the heart, and that's important as right. An area to make sure you're addressing. But also, you know, that T5 area, as you take that T5 and wrap T5 and follow that all the way around to like gallbladder 22, mm-hmm. right? And then wrapping it around to REN 17, that's a major area energetically that we would call that the ring around the chest. Right. And that is one of the distinguishing features of, you know, the bladder divergent channel. Right. And so that's a really big place where things become latent and stored. And that's an area that should be gua shaed and needled and all the different obstructions, you know, released, because that's an important part. And GB22 as one of the main. So it's a point. It's a meeting point on the sinew channels. And it's also a point on the small intestine heart divergent meridian. And mm-hmm. so this is a crucial point to be needling. And you can tie that treatment in to the small intestine heart divergent channel, because that also comes up to the face and helps to spread that wei qi up into the face and the sensory portals. And then of course into the brain, because you're also looking at bladder one. Right. So bladder one and GB22 as the confluent point. So that may in of itself, that channel system would probably be one of the best places to look for this type of acute, you know, severe scenario, along with the gua sha that wraps all the way around those areas. And then you can tie that in, you know, you could use liver gallbladder diversion channels and all those different aspects as well, because you need to get that wei qi open and the obstructions that are building up in from the thoracic cavity up through the SCM muscle into the head itself. And so mm-hmm. you know, the GB20s and on the end points and all those things are GB13 is one of my go-to points for that as well.
Cool, thank you very much, that's really helpful. Sure. We did do some on the Huato Zhaiji points and some also on the some gua sha as well, but not all of what you said, so that really helps. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you, Samantha. So does anyone else have any questions, or Jesse or Christy? Wow. So we've been going for almost 2 hours now, Ross. All yeah. this wealth of information that you have offered us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for hosting today. This was great.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm super, super grateful to you. This has been very helpful for me, and I'm sure, you know, everyone listening can take at least, you know, a few things away from this. I really like the clear way that you explain everything. I heard that Lauren referred to as a pulse master. So,
well, I don't know about that, but it's nice to hear, but I don't, you know, I don't know that I assume any of that.
The Shen Hammer system, it seems like probably the most comprehensive pulse system I've ever come across. And so who are the teachers now? You're a lineage holder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, you know, in the U.S., there aren't so many. You know, on the Northeast, I think at this point, I may be the only one. Phyllis Bloom, who was one of my first teachers and a dear friend, she's mostly retired these days. But Brant Stickley, you know, out west, mm-hmm. you know, he's out by the NUNM, and there's a number of people out that way as well who are certified teachers. And then there's a, you know, a whole host of people down in Florida, in Gainesville, where
right.
Dr. Hammer's school, you know, is still kind of chugging along and, you know, and training people.
Right. Yeah. Well, wonderful. So, and then how do people check out everything you've done? You spoke about the book Heart Shock. And then
yeah, so I have seminars. A couple of websites besides, mm-hmm. you know, besides the book, I have, you know, my website, rossrosen.com. I'm trying to update that. It keeps getting hit with some spam. So I'm working on that one to clear the spam. But that is probably the best place to find issues with, you know, classes, books, teachings, and so forth. Acupuncture and herbalmedicine.com is the website for my clinic, which also has a lot of teachings and videos and things as well. And, you know, I have this retreat center that we've been building for the past few years up in the Adirondacks. It's the property that used to belong to Dr. Hammer that I bought a few years ago. And we've been building and building and so once, I think probably soon already, we're just about, you know, people are starting to come out of their holes from C19. And I think we're going to start getting some in-person retreats and workshops, Pulse. We have something coming up with my Taoist brothers, Jack Schaefer and Josh Painter, where we're going to be doing weekend courses and training in the lost art of Juyo, which used to be a main part of Chinese medicine and was one of the departments of Chinese medicine in the Imperial Medical Academy up until the Ming Dynasty, when it was kind of ceremoniously cut out due to political reasons. But this is an old style of medicine that involves, you know, incantation and talisman and so forth. And since being cut out in the Ming, it's really been just kind of under the purview of the Taoist priests. But technically, these are things that were practiced by Chinese medicine practitioners. It's in the Su Wen. Qibo discusses it with the Yellow Emperor. This was practiced by Ge Hong and Sun Simiao and Ye Tian Shi and Wu Ju Tong and all these famous practitioners from our history in Chinese medicine. And so one does not actually need to be ordained to learn the applications of these. It is difficult. There's a number of requirements, but we're going to kind of bring people through all different stages of this through the course of multiple weekends together. And we're probably going to do that up in my retreat center in the Adirondacks in Dr. Hammer's old stomping grounds. So I'm looking forward to advertising that soon.
Oh, wow. How fun is that? That's amazing.
It's going to be amazing.
Ooh, I'm excited for you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. All right. Well, do you think there's anything else that you feel like we maybe should touch on before we wrap up the room, Russ?
No, I think we're good. I think we covered a lot of stuff. And, you know, I did go into a little bit more detail in particular topics in that webinar, but, you know, I think especially in terms of treatment, but I think I gave the basic foundation for it. So.
Yes. Yeah. Perfect. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ross, for your time. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this evening. Thank you, Christy. Thank you, Jesse. Please check out all of, you know, the courses and teachings that Ross has to offer. Feel free to follow the club. If you click on my profile, hit follow, and then go all the way down to the bottom and to the left, there's a little yin-yang sign, and you can actually become a member of this club on Clubhouse for the closed rooms. Or you can follow the club without following me. too. That's fine. it's just they won't let you actually be a member, but I don't know if that, we'll see, because I probably will do closed rooms just so like random people who just happen on it aren't in our, you know, acupuncture rooms. Right. But and then also Jesse has a club, the Daily Tao, which he holds it down like every night of the week at 9:30 Eastern Standard Time, which is really impressive to have that sort of consistency. So if you ever just want to listen to Jesse's calming, soothing voice and hear people talk about Taoism, and you know, sometimes he throws the I Ching for us, which is nice. Feel free to follow that club too.
And I want to invite Ross on anytime he likes. It's great to share some space and to hear your perspective on such an important topic. Thank you so much.
Oh, great. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for having me. And I hope to join into some of these in the near future.
Thank you so much, Ross. It's been a great weekend studying under you. Really.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
All right, everyone. I'm going to wrap up the room now. So we'll do the countdown. sending you all a virtual wave. I hope you have a really great rest of your evening and a good week ahead of you, helping tons of people. May this talk be for the benefit of all beings, and I will see you guys at the next event. This room will self-destruct in 3, 2, and 1. Good night, everyone.